Hello, and welcome to another episode of Exiting the Cave Short Reads. This is episode 2 of The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius. In our last episode, we were introduced to Boethius, and he was feeling particularly sorry for himself, at which point philosophy appears to console him. In this episode, entitled The Mists Dispelled, philosophy reminds Boethius of the context within which he appears. Without further ado, I'll just move directly into the reading, and I will offer some parting thoughts afterward. See you then. Then the gloom of night was scattered, sight returned unto my eyes. So, when haply rainy Caurus rolls the storm clouds through the skies, hidden is the sun. All heaven is obscured in starless night. But if, in wild onset sweeping, Boreas frees day's prisoned light, all suddenly the radiant good outstreams, and strikes our dazzled eyesight with his beams. Even so, the clouds of my melancholy were broken up. I saw the clear sky, and regained the power to recognize the face of my physician. Accordingly, when I had lifted my eyes and fixed my gaze upon her, I beheld my nurse, Philosophy, whose halls I had frequented from my youth up. Ah, why, I cried, mistress of all excellence, hast thou come down from on high and entered the solitude of this my exile? Is it that thou too, even as I, mayst be persecuted with false accusations? Could I desert thee, child, she said, and not lighten the burden which thou hast taken upon thee through the hatred of my name by sharing this trouble? Even forgetting that it were not lawful for philosophy to leave companionless the way of the innocent, should I, thinkest thou, fear to incur reproach or shrink from it, as though some strange new thing had befallen? Thinkest thou that now, for the first time in an evil age, wisdom hath been assailed by peril? Did I not often, in days of old, before my servant Plato lived, wage stern warfare with the rashness of folly? In his lifetime, too, Socrates, his master, won with my aid the victory of an unjust death. And when, one after the other, the Epicurean herd, the Stoic, and the rest, each of them, as far as in them lay, went about to seize the heritage he left, and were dragging me off, protesting and resisting, as their booty they tore in pieces the garment which I had woven with my own hands, and, clutching the torn pieces, went off, believing that the whole of me had passed into their possession. And some of them, because some traces of my vesture were seen upon them, were destroyed through the mistake of the lewd multitude, who falsely deemed them to be my disciples. It may be thou knowest not of the banishment of Anaxagoras, of the poison draught of Socrates, nor of Zeno's torturing, because these things happened in a distant country. Yet mightest thou have learned the fate of Arius, of Seneca, of Soranus, whose stories are neither old nor unknown to fame. These men were brought to destruction for no other reason than that, settled as they were in my principles, their lives were a manifest contrast to the ways of the wicked. So there is nothing thou shouldst wonder at, if on the seas of this life we are tossed by storm blast, seeing that we have made it our chiefest aim to refuse compliance with evildoers. And though, maybe, the host of the wicked is many in number, yet is it contemptible, since it is under no leadership, but is hurried hither and thither at the blind driving of mad error. And if at times and seasons they set in array against us, and fall on in overwhelming strength, Our leader draws off her forces into the citadel while they are busy plundering the useless baggage. But we, from our vantage ground, safe from all this wild work, laugh to see them making prize of the most valueless of things, protected by a bulwark which aggressive folly may not aspire to reach. There are four insights I'd like to highlight from this week's reading. To begin with, the verse segment in this chapter is an allegorical contrast between Kaurus and Boreas. The god Kaurus was the Roman version of the Greek god Skiron, the god of the northwest winds, and a bringer of winter. Boreas, of course, is also a bringer of winter. So both gods are responsible for cold winter winds. But the former brings storms, and the latter clear skies. Boethius uses the Greek name for the god that brings the sun, and the Roman name for the god that brings the storms. If I were to speculate here, I would suggest that this is a not-so-subtle framing of the work itself, and of Boethius' own situation, condemned to death by his Roman brethren, but given a glimpse of Plato's son as respite for his plight. Second, Boethius is amazed to recognize Lady Philosophy. He asks, more or less, "What are you doing here? Have they gotten you too?" At which point she disabuses him of his error and reminds him that he is but one episode in a grand historical drama in which she has been the central character throughout. The way this is written, it could be read in one of two ways, I think. Either Boethius is indulging his vanity, "Look at me, I'm to be counted among the likes of Socrates and Seneca," or, more charitably, it could be read as a chastisement to humility. Lady Philosophy reminds him, after all, that she is duty-bound to be present with the innocent in their time of need. Historically speaking, Boethius' vanity might actually be warranted. After all, here we are reading his book. Thirdly, and of particular interest to me, is the fact that Lady Philosophy disparages the Epicureans and the Stoics as plunderers and false prophets. This is important because one character that dominates the rest of Book 1 is Stoic philosophy. Boethius, in spite of this beratement from Lady Philosophy, makes heavy use of Stoic concepts in his consolation. As we'll see, though, these are all primarily linked to Aristotelian ideas of telos and virtue, rather than Stoic detachment or fate. In any case, this is a second instance of contrary tensions in the meta-narrative taking place. It first occurred in the previous reading. Lady Philosophy sends the poetic muses packing and chides them for indulging Boethius' self-pity with inspirations to beautiful rhymes. Now, she's disparaging the Stoics for their pretensions to philosophy and their willingness to plunder those that went before them. Yet in both cases, Boethius himself is making full use of what philosophy is warning against. The entire work is cast as a dialogue between the muses and reason, and as I mentioned, the whole of Book 1 is dominated by Stoic philosophy. What is going on here? Well, in the case of the muses, this could be a callback to Plato's Republic, in which Plato banishes all forms of poetry and music from his imaginary republic that do not strictly serve the needs of the philosophical ideal. But in the case of the Stoics, it's not clear what Boethius is intending to imply. Perhaps, I would suggest, he was aware that Stoicism was not a satisfactory answer to his problem, and expressed it through the mouth of philosophy herself. The last thing I want to point out about this chapter is the heavy-handed moral dichotomy being set up by Boethius. It's glorious philosophy against a sea of wickedness and debauchery. In part, he's doing this to frame the questions that will be posed in the next few chapters. But also, he's repeating an oft-deployed trope of philosophical literature. The tone and meter of Lady Philosophy's rant is clearly meant to call to mind Socrates' indignance in the opening monologue of the Apology. "Oh, you men of Athens!" The irony in this, of course, is that Boethius takes Greece to be his rescuer at a time when the men of Rome are committing exactly the same crime by his lights. And I think that's going to do it for episode 2. I hope these insights were helpful, and stay tuned next week when Boethius states his first case to philosophy.